Undeniably, the world remains plagued by crisis and a host of enduring injustices owed to colonial power and domination.
In turn, countless revolutionary thinkers from times past and present have identified modernity as a point source of oppression.
When taking stock of the violent ways in which modernity was and continues to be forged, the Caribbean has been ground zero. That is the crucible of modernity.
As an intervention that centers the Caribbean, this season of Surviving Society will provide a window into several of the region's grassroots struggles for land, life, and liberation.
Do you want to read books that challenge capitalism and give you tools to fight back against oppression? Surviving Society is partnering with radical independent publisher Pluto Press to bring you books by exciting young authors, as well as classics by writers who defined our movements.
Throughout 2024, you can grab 50% off all books on their website by using the code SURVIVING50. Go to PlutoBooks.com to check out the books.
On today's episode, we spoke with series co-host and co-producer, Johanna Ray Rez, an activist and organizer with an extensive track record of frontline experience across the Caribbean. Johanna is currently a project and community outreach associate with CAISO, as well as a sign language interpreter working with several CSOs, including the Deaf Empowerment and Advancement Foundation and the Alliance for Justice and Diversity. Welcome, everyone. We're going to begin the series by talking to co-host and co-producer of The Crucible of Modernity, Johanna Ray Rez, joining us from Trinidad and Tobago. Johanna, we've wrapped up and recorded the entire season of The Crucible of Modernity. We've got a very radical roster of guests coming up for listeners to engage with in the weeks to come. But before we do that, I thought it would be a good idea to start off the season and series by also engaging with you, as well as hearing a bit about some of the work that you're doing in the Caribbean. So we're very much focusing on this notion of modernity, as well as then too, a lot of the different contemporary struggles as well as challenges that exist in the region. Just to kick off the series, in thinking about the realities of modernity as well as the historical trajectories of colonialism and what that has meant for the region, from your vantage point, what are some of the major challenges that exist in the Caribbean, as well as then too, perhaps what are some of the solutions to some of those challenges posed by modernity?
I'm so happy to be here. Just really excited for the podcast to come out, because we did have lots of conversations with diverse group of people talking about the region, many topics that are relevant to the Caribbean. I thought it was really interesting, the different perspectives that came up in terms of the challenges that, you know, we do experience. Because when you think about the Caribbean, I mean, depending on, you know, where you are, like different, you know, pictures, you know, could come to mind. It could be this place where people come, you know, in order to live like very carefree lives. You know, sea, sun and sand, I think is the slogan for the region in general. People associate us with reggae music, you know, one love, etc. But then there's also this sense that the Caribbean, you know, is a violent place and it's unsafe. And there are all these tourist advisories, you know, blanketed across these tourism websites sometimes about the Caribbean or about specific Caribbean islands. The best word to say that, you know, it's complex, right? The space. And the challenges that we face are also, you know, very complex in nature. So we are currently, you know, experiencing changes as a result of the climate caused by humans putting, you know, carbon into the environment and, you know, causing global warming and, you know, all of these things. We often experience, you know, the brunt of that in terms of neoliberal policies and also like capitalism. So all of these large companies that are, you know, producing products, clothing, etc. Often it's, you know, dumped here, sold very cheap, then it ends up in the landfills here. So we have, you know, a whole host of environmental challenges. Then there's, you know, issues with gender and sexuality. It's a recurring theme that happens within, you know, the discourses on personal level, there are people, you know, dealing with challenges in their families, and then also on a policy level where we have a number of, you know, policies that are, you know, discriminatory to people of the LGBTQ community. That's something that the movement is currently, you know, dealing with and, you know, grappling with in the political sense. And then I think just like our political situation in general, we have a number of political parties that borrow from Western conservative ideals. And this has been a continuous challenge because I think the young people and people who have been marginalized over the past decades, centuries, etc., want to renegotiate a new social contract. You know, we want something different, but this chokehold that conservative religious politics kind of has on the region, it's a really tight grip. And that's something that we've been grappling it with. And all of those things are interconnected and intertwined in a really complex tapestry garment, however you want to say it.
No, it's a very eloquent way to sort of summarize both the challenges as well as possibilities of the Caribbean. It seems like you're very much alluding to the lasting legacies and on an enduring colonial aftermath that the region's continuing to grapple with, whether it's in the sociocultural domain in terms of belief systems as well as respectability politics, but also in the political economic arena with respect to extraction, consumption, the degree to which the region is bought and sold, marketed, what it is framed and advertised and purported to be, how it's consumed, who's able to consume it, what narratives and discourses end up emerging about the region with respect to its at once an unspoiled paradise, according to some brochures, but then on some pieces of literature, it's this dangerous place in which people need to seek shelter, sort of is profane and is a place that is where crime is endemic, these sorts of things. And you're very much, I think, you have your finger on the pulse of these, as well as in two, engaged in a lot of struggles, making interventions into those challenges. I'm wondering on that front, you mentioned a variety of different things. I know that your local grounded efforts have not only taken place in Trinidad, but you've done work, solidaristic work, political advocacy work all throughout the region, Circumcaribbean, you've been to Central America. I'm wondering, in terms of some of the things that you're talking about, these broad global challenges that are very much operating across the region, climate change, oppressive institutions with respect to gender and sexuality, as well as then to environmental degradation, which is tied and has links to the trajectory of the plantation and plantation economies, these sorts of things. What are some of the things that you're engaged in terms of day-to-day frontline work that's making an intervention into some of these challenges?
I remember this really amazing book that I was reading. It's called A Thousand Splendid Suns by Khaled Hosseini. And he had this really great line in there where he's just like, every step you take, you knock over a poet. And I kind of feel that way about Trinidad. But like, you know, if you take like the next two steps, you'll be confronted by, you know, some cause, some situation where you kind of had to make, you have to make the choice whether you're like, okay, I have a civil duty and, you know, a tie to this country and I feel like I need to do something about it. Or maybe you might be overwhelmed by just simply, you know, the tasks that are required to just like live. And you might just say, I can't do that today. Especially since I've left university, I think I've had a number of opportunities where, you know, I would come across, you know, a situation or something that's happening. And then I have to make a decision about whether, you know, I have the skills or the capacity or, you know, whatever to help or like make some type of intervention, because I mean, that's why we go to school. That's why, you know, we do all these things so that we could be equipped, you know, to contribute. Yeah, I've just had many of those experiences. And currently I'm working at CAISO, CAISO Sex and Gender Justice. Initially, it was just CAISO. It was called the Coalition Advocating for the Inclusion of Sexual Orientation. But since we've been registered as an organization, it's CAISO Sex and Gender Justice, because the range of advocacy has been, you know, expanded to simply just, you know, inclusion of sexual orientation, but we also want to think about sex as well as, you know, gender identity. I I'm the Community Outreach and Projects Associate at the organization. The project that I'm primarily responsible for is called Sign Together. It's essentially a sign language training course. We recently expanded to level 4 and 5, where we train members of the LGBTQ community, as well as service providers within the community who may not be of the community themselves, to learn Trinidad and Tobago Sign Language. My last semester at university, where I did this course called Deaf Language and Culture, I graduated. I then went back and audited a course called Caribbean Sign Language Usage. And then I started working at the Lloyd Best Institute, and I had deaf co-workers. I would have done a research project on a sign language that was used within an indigenous community in Guyana. So I lived there for a while. Just before COVID, and then COVID actually cut the projects short, and we haven't been able to go back. Yeah, so doing work in Trinidad as well as, you know, working in Guyana as well, you kind of come across the similarities in these situations with regards to access to public goods and services for people who are part of this linguistic minority. But then you'd come across little differences in terms of, you know, vocabulary or even structure of the community. That's, you know, my primary role at CAISO, and in addition to organizing sometimes fun things, you know, like a RuPaul's Drag Race finale watching party, other skill sharing, you know, activities and such. You know, you really see the difference that could be made on an individual level, but also in coalition with other organizations, you see that, you know, there is like this possibility for becoming, you know, this kind of like political force, developing policy documents. Yeah, I've just had a lot of opportunities within the organization to, you know, do work on different levels where you're dealing with people directly, and then when you're trying to interact with the state, this large machinery that sometimes doesn't have a face or doesn't let you see the faces behind there.
Okay, you're involved in no shortage of emancipatory projects, it sounds like, as well as in, too, of course, making sure that you enjoy the finer things in life, like getting together and watching RuPaul's Drag Race together.
That's right. Team Anitra.
I don't know enough to make an informed statement about it, but I'm 100% supportive of all those types of gatherings. Amidst your work with CAISO, you're also a hearing interpreter that does advocacy and support work with deaf communities across the region. You mentioned that briefly about your experience in Guyana. But I'm wondering, what does some of that work entail, as well as in two, I'm particularly interested in, you mentioned the state, and when it comes to struggles for justice, whether it be health justice, environmental justice, social justice, gender justice, vis-a-vis sexuality and gender, what are you up against in Trinidad and Tobago, but also more, I think some of these things are applicable throughout the region with respect to the form and function of the state. What possibilities are there, and what challenges and limitations are you up against?
I am a hearing interpreter. I do work with the Trinidad and Tobago Deaf Organization. So there are a couple, but the main one that's deaf-led is the Deaf Empowerment and Advancement Foundation. Yes, there is a difference between a hearing interpreter and a deaf interpreter. And yes, there are deaf interpreters. I function as a hearing interpreter. So sometimes I would interpret for events solo, as in just me, and I'm interpreting, sign in on screen or in person. And sometimes I would work with a deaf interpreter, depending on the nature of the topic. So if it's something complex, like the law or the economy, I would probably work with a deaf interpreter because they have a specific, you know, capacity as native speakers to be able to break down these complex things, you know, really quickly. Because we have such a diverse linguistic community with people who use TTSL as their sole language, and then people who use TTSL and American Sign Language mixed. And then there are people who, like younger people, who mainly, you know, would use ASL. And that could be very difficult if you're a hearing person and you're trying to communicate with a knowledge of all this variation. But, you know, deaf interpreters tend to have a better grasp on that because they're accustomed communicating with people basically use different languages all the time. It's interesting because in that process, you kind of are forced to, I guess, be humble. And, you know, it's really hard to like have this whole savior, you know, complex. When you forget the sign for like coffee, or you can't remember how to sign Starbucks and you have to ask, you know, so it's really great. And I love my introduction, you know, into the deaf community, because I had to have a firm grasp on that humility. It was a really good experience in terms of being a part of a deaf-led organization. And I'm very comfortable in the background, very comfortable in that number two position. It's been great. In terms of the challenges that we've experienced, I realized across these different groups that I've been a part of, or people who I've been, you know, in solidarity with, it's kind of like the same thing in terms of, you know, having to encourage people who are around us who don't have the same, you know, experiences that we've had with a particular community, and try to do that cultural paradigm shift type of work. So with the Sign Together program, it's, you know, introducing them to deaf people and, you know, deaf culture. Well, not me doing the introducing, but the deaf tutors who are leading the way. But I'm just kind of there like a case study, or like, I did it too. And this is how long I took to learn sign language as a hearing person. And I love it, which I do. So it's doing the interpersonal work, one-on-one, sometimes conversations about, you know, or just kind of interpreting for a one-on-one conversation between a hearing person and a deaf person, and, you know, doing that work. And then with Kaiso, sometimes it's having a very difficult conversation with somebody on Facebook and being like, well, what you're actually saying is incorrect, and you're going up into people's faces, or they're actually up in yours, but you're not backing down, and you're like, well, actually, you're wrong, you know, in terms of there's only a man and a woman, but what about intersex people? And then there's like bird chirping, or they change the target of the conversation or the goal. And, you know, trying to navigate those things, because as an organization or as activists, we could say, well, you know, that's not what we should preoccupy ourselves with. But that's like the whole point, you know, getting everybody to release, you know, all of the trauma that they've experienced, you know, from colonization, all of the trauma they've experienced in school, wherever, and just get them to release that, and then be able to see everyone who's around them as people. Kind of like that Black Mirror episode. I think it was called Man on Fire.
So spoiler alert.
Trigger warning. I'm going to spoil it. but yeah, essentially where they had like those army people, and they were going into, you know, the houses with the contacts in their eyes, and they were seeing, you know, these creatures. But then when that one army guy, his contact wasn't working, and he took it out and he saw that it was like people he was shooting. And, you know, it's just kind of having that moment, like breaking the contacts, not literally, but, you know, the that lens. Yeah. So culture, people, interpersonal relationships, that's one. Then there's the conversation or the engagement with the state, which is usually you going up against a brick wall. Sometimes literally, because some of these buildings, they're not accessible. they're not open. And you actually have to go to the one down the street, sometimes in a next like area. So you go to Port of Spain and they're like, well, actually this office is closed. You have to go to Arima, which is on the other side of the island, which is not that big, but, you know, it's really frustrating sometimes. Or you're calling and there's like a figurative wall because you're just lost in this PBX system and clicking numbers and trying to get to speak to who you have to speak to. Or you have to find like somebody who will be like, hey, here's the entrance, you know, and finding people who could be interlocutors within the state, you know, machinery. So the first up is just trying to, you know, get in, and then to be able to bring your points across and come up with suggestions and try to propose interventions that, you know, policymakers could consider that would be useful and helpful for the communities that, you know, we support, that we represent, that, you know, we're a part of.
Okay, it sounds like you're doing quite a bit of building solidarity across differences as well as accompaniment work, which in the types of labyrinths that you're talking about seems necessary and significant, if not essential. Oddly enough, I can't watch Black Mirror because I'm too sensitive. I've watched two or three episodes and just like my spirit can't take this. I think because, like you were saying, it hits a little too close to home with respect to some of the dynamics that it's portraying about society. Rather than doing a deep dive into Black Mirror, but you've mentioned effectively the degree to which the soldiers in this episode were looking at what were humans, but actually they had some sort of device in their contact lens that dehumanized those humans. And it seems like the Caribbean as a region is defined by struggles against dehumanization, as well as struggles for or to assert one's humanity, irrespective of what background or diverse orientation different communities have in the Caribbean. So seemingly makes quite a bit of sense that the episode about dehumanization is something that resonated with the frontline work that you're doing, as well as into what impact does that have physically, as well as into psychologically. As well as on this note of dehumanization, not to pivot too much of a sobering topic, but I'm wondering, what are some of the other ways in which struggles for emancipation or struggles to assert one's humanity continues to operate in the Caribbean? Of course, and you've already alluded to the myriad ways in which dehumanization continues to operate and what impacts that's having. But then too, what are some of the other struggles as well as fights for liberation that are emerging in the Caribbean? What do those look like?
A couple of years ago, there was this incident where three men were murdered by the police in Mova. I used to live on that same street in Caledonia. So I used to live there with my mother, my two brothers at the time, I have four in total now, and my aunt and her two daughters. So we had an apartment there. My aunt was allowing us to stay there while we were trying to sort out our lives. So when I saw, you know, this story like come up on the news, I was just like, hey, I know where that, you know, place is. I know the rum shop that they went to because it was one of the guy's birthdays. He was celebrating his birthday. He and his friends, you know, were on the way to the rum shop, you know, to get drinks to celebrate their birthday. Police car pulled up and the three men, they ended up dying. Now, initially, the story was that, you know, one of the guys had a gun. They pulled it on the police and then the officers then returned fire and they killed the man. But then someone who was living like right opposite there, he had CCTV, you know, cameras in his house. And he saw any footage that's not what happened. And then the footage was made public. Then there were a series of, you know, uprisings that happened as a result. So it started off in Caledonia, then it moved down to Beetham, and then, you know, I think up until 20 communities rose up against police violence. And I mean, it's not surprising because that's something that happens specifically in hotspot areas. And the narrative of they pulled the gun on us first, so then we return fire narrative is something that's always used, but isn't always true. That was kind of another incident. I was with Womantra at the time. That's a feminist organization. It was interesting, you know, inspiring. And it was also just a really sad story. He was celebrating his birthday and was murdered. And it escalated even more when, you know, at the protest, there were several instances where police would then violence again. And then a woman, you know, she was shot. The case has been moving along. Like the police complaints authority, they, you know, did their report, they did their investigation, would have communicated with the DPP, you know, with the TTPS, the commissioner at the time. But that entire situation, I mean, you kind of read about it in like history books, that kind of thing happening, and the uprising on such a wide scale. It was wild being present, you know, for most of it happening. And that was just another time where you kind of like, okay, what do I do in this situation? Do I do, you know, anything? And your intervention mightn't be necessary, but just kind of documenting the what took place, you know, an intervention. So it's there, it's documented. This is what happened. And this is the story, you know, that this is the perspective that we want to make sure is present now and 10 years down the road, doing that work that we did when we were, you know, writing the articles. I did, you know, interviews with people who were part of the protests, and just kind of got their stories and got them down, you know, on paper so that, you know, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, you know, when people are looking at it, they don't just see the one narrative, you know, with the unruly, you know, people in the hotspots, you know, just trying to make trouble or whatever the politicians were saying, you know, at the time in terms of, oh, these were paid protesters. Yeah, somebody had enough money to pay thousands of people in 20 communities across Trinidad to protest for 3 days. Right. That was, I think, one of the struggles that we have where there's a sense of like people who are in marginalized groups, they want their human rights, you know, they want their human rights. They want to live. They want to have the same opportunities that they see, you know, other people having. But the system is, you know, hierarchical. It's discriminatory. It's just violent, you know, towards specific groups of people. And there's a constant tug and pull. And this tug and pull has been going on, you know, for decades, centuries. However long there have been oppressed people, there have been people who have been, you know, fighting, you know, oppression. And yeah, I think it's kind of one long stream of battles for, you know, for human rights, for life, that's been happening in the region. And I mean, I'm not sure, you know, at what point or what would be required to completely rid, you know, ourselves in the Caribbean of that constant, you know, back and forth. But it's good to know that the back and forth, you know, is happening, and there are people not just accepting, you know, inhumane treatment and dehumanization.
There's an incredible amount going on there, Johanna. It seems like there's a historical as well as structural component of the violence that you're talking about in terms of the police-involved killings. I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit more context and details about the socio-spatial dimensions that you had mentioned. So I'll just rattle off some of the aspects of what was happening that you were talking about. And then if you could explain those to folks who aren't initiated with the unique spatialities of Trinidad and Tobago. But you mentioned hotspots, Beetham, Mova, as well as then too, I think, the social dynamics of who was targeted, who ended up being killed, and by whom matters a great deal. That was also, if I remember correctly, taking place amidst the pandemic, and it was shortly after the murder of George Floyd, I believe. And I remember hearing from a few of the different participants who you had engaged with who were referring to that as Trinidad's George Floyd moment. So this issue and matter of the systemic nature of police brutality, state-sponsored violence, as well as then too in the unique setting that is in Trinidad and Tobago, but also then too operates throughout the Caribbean. I think it's important to mention, as you have, that whilst the Caribbean is not immune to structural violence, it is also something that communities are dealing with. So in terms of the socio-spatial dimensions of the police brutality that you just were talking about, I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more about what's unique about MOVA, about Beetham Gardens, about to the people who ended up being killed, as well as in two, what was some of the discourse or the way in which this issue was being talked about, one from the community level, but then also two from state officials. What was some of the language that was being used to describe what was going on and why the response was what it was on behalf of the state?
Trinidad is a oil producing state. This whole conversation about, like, I think in the like late 90s or early 90s, whenever, about the petrochemical coup, right? And it's essentially, you know, with all this money that we've gotten from oil, along came with it, you know, a host of problems, with one of them being crime. Crime became, you know, a huge issue. in Trinidad, because you'd hear like older people talking about, I don't remember Trinidad have all this crime, you know, all this sort of killing and thing. And they read the newspapers and they're in shock, you know, where a next man get killed today. And while those of us who are like a little bit younger or whatever, we're like, okay, well, we kind of grew up, you know, hearing the news stories and reading the newspapers or looking at it on our phones now, seeing, you know, murders and stuff. So that has been something, you know, that's been a problem, crime. You know, the police, they've always been called upon to do something about the crime. And the commissioners always saying, yes, we're doing something about the crime. And I think, you know, in them doing something about the crime, they would have, you know, probably done, you know, some type of work looking at, you know, where crime is happening or where criminals are coming from. And they developed this hotspot, you know, map or this understanding of Trinidad and Tobago that has pinpointed some communities as being quote unquote hotspots for crime. It's not shocking that these communities are places where majority Black people live, they're places where majority poor people live. Those things, you know, aren't shocking to anyone. Or even where, you know, often migrants would settle, because we would have a lot of people who would come across from, you know, smaller islands in the Caribbean and settle in these communities. So Mova is one of those communities where they have a series of low cost housing, you know, developments, as well as Beetham Gardens was established as one of those low cost housing developments, also where people would have settled in terms of unplanned housing settlements as well. So there's Beetham, there's also Sea Lots, and these places are located around on the outskirts of our capital, Port of Spain. In terms of the three men who were shot, they were Black, they were men, they were low income earning or employed within the informal sector, and men. So in terms of, if we're looking at, you know, just identity, geography, etc., you kind of get a sense of the many identities and, you know, the marginalized status and how layered, you know, that is for each individual involved. Also to add, in terms of the situation that happened in Mova, there was a police officer that was murdered the day before, PC Mosley, and he was murdered about a couple blocks away from where the car with Joel, Noel, and Israel was intercepted. Lord alone knows what was the connection in terms of the murder. There are a couple rumors, but I'm not going to repeat that on an international podcast. So yeah, so that was basically the situation. And in interviewing people who attended protests, people who live in the area, they felt that it was, you know, racial profiling. They saw, you know, a bunch of, you know, Black men in a car, and, you know, there's this perception or stereotype about, you know, Black men in groups moving around in, you know, quote unquote hotspot communities. And the police officers, you know, don't treat people who live in communities like that as human beings. And they often, you know, have a sense that they're less than and not worthy of being, you know, treated fairly, go through the proper judicial process, etc. And that is a common thing that police officers do. Like, there are many cases that happen where people who live in quote unquote hotspot communities are treated like almost like you're guilty on site, and then you have to prove your innocence after, as opposed to the other way around. So one of the participants in the research project that we were doing, we're talking about the discourse that was happening, particularly within the politicians when they had media briefings, right? So there were a couple of politicians who spoke out on the matter. So the prime minister, he had a statement. The minister of security at the time made a statement. And then a couple of the MPs for the quote-unquote hotspot areas would have made statements. And then also the commissioner, the police commissioner at the time had a lot to say. And I mean, all of it where they talked about, you know, criminal elements, cockroaches, or people who want to unsettle the nation, things like that. They kind of, well, one, dehumanized them by using those terms, but people in the community felt that by using those terms, it was almost as a way to excuse the way that they're treated in hotspot communities. So if you take away the fact that they're people, then it's easier to sell the idea that you know, this is for the good of the country, or what the police is doing is for the people, when it's not, when they're killing people's father or father figure, and they're killing people's children, and you know, they're just taking away lives that, you know, is not for them to take. So a number of those things came up in the discussions that we would have had with participants who attended. A lot of things came up, but that's what's top of mind in my memory since you asked that question.
No, it gives people a good sense of the ways in which state officials, as well as the state more broadly, can mobilize discourses of nationalism to criminalize and dehumanize certain communities, as well as into sickening paradox, seemingly, in that criminalized hotspot communities in Trinidad, much like anywhere else in the world, are at once abandoned and forsaken by the state in terms of resources, entitlements, welfare, infrastructure, but then also to receive some of the most intense types of attention, i.e., violence and surveillance, that any community in the world could face. And very much your engagement with the community members seemed to return results that were shocking, if not startling, but also at the same time, not surprising. If you read something like The Wretched of the Earth, seemingly 60 years later, it effectively feels like Fanon said there would be days like this, these sorts of things. And I mentioned Fanon because I know that you were the lead author on a couple of different chapters about this issue, as well as then too the way in which discourses were mobilized against these communities, as well as then too the historical trajectory of the Trinidad and Tobago police force, and oftentimes the colonial moorings and ties that remain and continue to resonate in the contemporary moment. Back to that issue of the state-sponsored violence and police brutality that emerged, that then prompted seemingly a national response to some degree. I'm wondering, what was that response that also then led to a very disheartening murder? Could you expand a little bit upon how Trinidad and Tobago responded to those killings?
The killings happened, and then there was a protest within the community. So members from all parts of, you know, MOVA, basically came together in Second Caledonia, which is where the killings would have happened, and you know, they were standing up for the families who were affected by these murders, the men themselves, who they would have known, went to school with, were friends with, were neighbors. That inspired a series of other protests that would have happened across the country. So it was literally all over the country, and you know, those uprisings happened over the past over the course of three days. It was similar, quote unquote, hotspot areas. I mean, I would think it's because of the shared trauma, you know, that people have. They had similar experiences with the police in those communities, and you know, that's why they would have stood up like this. But also, you mentioned it before, it happened during the COVID period. And it also happened, I think, about a month after, you know, the George Floyd situation would have, you know, George Floyd was murdered by the police. It was televised. There were, you know, there was a video that everyone saw on Facebook, as well as, you know, international news. There was even a protest that happened here in solidarity with the Black community in the US, as there were smaller protests around the world. It was happening, yeah, in within that period of time. So I think that might have, you know, heightened people's senses, and then, you know, what would have been like the first point where we would have, you know, empathized and been in solidarity with the folks in the US. And then this one happened, and there was video evidence that was also shared widely on social media. Injustice was hard to watch for Black people here, and then to see another instance, you know, where you were seeing police officers being violent and being caught in a lie, essentially, would have really affected people as well. Because first it happened in the US and you're just watching it, you're feeling bad for this man, seeing the way that he was treated. And then to see it happen, you know, a block down the road or on your street, it make you angry all over again. there were people, specifically Ornella, who was murdered. She went to the protest and her mother was asking her, where are you going? And she's just like, I have to go. And, you know, they're protesting. These people were murdered and, you know, she had to go and participate in the protest to find out later that her brother was also murdered by the police. Her brother, Christopher Greaves, was murdered. He went to the shop to get snacks for his children, and he was walking back with the snacks in his hand, and then he was confronted by the police. It was late in the night. Well, I don't know what the police thought, you know, about the snacks in his hand. They ended up shooting him. So the story was they thought that he pulled a gun on them when it was really just snacks in his hand, and they shot him. And I mean, there were conflicting stories about what happened after, because it wasn't like a murder where he was killed on site. You know, he could have been taken to the hospital, but there were conflicting reports in newspaper articles about what, you know, could have been done about that situation. The point is that, you know, Ornella felt like it was really important. And then for her to be murdered at the protest, it was really sad to see that happen. I remembered me and a couple other activists from Omantra, you know, we really just kind of sat and like had that, let that heaviness, you know, sit, where, you know, this woman who was pregnant at the time, you know, was really standing up for her family member who she lost, standing up for something that she believed in, and, you know, ended up being killed. Yeah, sometimes it gets really emotional, and it could, you know, get to you, like that whole point. So it's just like a very sad situation. And thinking about what the intervention could be in that moment when things like that happen.
The degree to which different community members were asserting their political agency, as well as then too, I mean, it's unfortunate, not to belabor the point, but then too, what it's like to go through a surreal, heartbreaking experience of seeing people standing up for themselves against seemingly impossible circumstances, as well as powerful institutions, as well as police forces, and then being subjected to more violence, and how that generates more trauma for immediate family members, for people who loved and cared about those people, but then also too, just for society across the board. And then what do you do with that trauma?
Yeah. And I wonder, because I remembered the protest that we had in solidarity with George Floyd, and it was at the Queen's Park Savannah in front of the U.S. Embassy. And there were police officers there. There were people, you know, young people. It was mainly like university students, you know, like artists, you know, poets. Like, I don't know if like that communicates a type of crowd to, you know, listeners. But it wasn't. I mean, some people may have been from hotspot communities, but I guess because of their other identities, it kind of balances it out, you know, because of who was there and where it was. It was in front of the, you know, it was in front of the U.S. embassy. The ambassador came out, you know, he didn't say anything, but he, you know, he was there looking on. Thing like that happened. Nobody was shot. Even though when the police commissioner came on, the police officers were there, people were in their face, you know, saying stuff or whatever. Nothing happened. Nobody got shot. But then you have, you know, the situation where it's residents from the quote unquote hotspot communities. There were also some videos that were purportedly to be from, you know, Anella's phone. She was taken to the hospital by the police because, I mean, there was a lot of people there. They had to act. Based on the reports, like her dying words were her pointing at a police officer saying, "Is you who shoot me?" In terms of what has come out of the Police Complaints Authority investigation, you know, and the TTPS's investigations that hasn't been made public as yet. And it's something that I would follow up on regularly around the anniversary of her murder. And I mean, as a civilian, there's only so much you could ask for. There's only so much you can get. But, you know, they would say that based on the last time that I would have communicated with the PCA, they would have said that their report would have went off to the TTPS and there's only so much they can do. And I think that's kind of one of the other difficult things about interacting with the state. It's so complex and it's almost like it's that way for a reason, so that you kind of get lost in this labyrinth trying to access justice. So I guess that's another aspect of what it's like, doing change work in a way that is nonviolent. Not saying that not there's any, I don't have any issue with nonviolent and, violent ways. I'm not saying one is better or worse, but it's just that's the way that I'm going about things at the moment, with letters and phone calls. And we'll see how far that gets.
No, it seems Kafka-esque, as well as like you're inside a maze and a morass that's seemingly impossible to navigate. And there's layers of plausible deniability and a diffusion of responsibility that then just make sure that the status quo remains the same and that the state gets to absolve itself from any wrongdoing, and act with impunity. And it seemingly would be at once infuriating, as well as then too, while you're dealing with the fact that people are losing their lives, as well as then too, I think it was quite revelatory the way in which you were sort of describing those instances in which the state was responding with firing bullets into crowds seemingly indiscriminately versus those contexts in which they were, for lack of a better way of putting it, behaving themselves better so as not to be seen as violent or have recordings, or there were certain spaces that were where violence against people and communities is acceptable, and then there were contexts in which it wasn't acceptable. It's certainly a harrowing ordeal, and it seems like there's a lot of accountability that needs to emerge from this scenario. And as we're discussing some of the challenges that you mentioned in the Caribbean, not to dwell on the negative, as well as then to focus specifically on the dehumanizing aspects of what you're standing up against, but I'm also wondering too, in terms of taking stock of the realities of the Caribbean, I pick this up from different Maya communities I've worked with in Belize. They oftentimes reflect upon and focus on the differing communities' joys, pains, and dreams. We've certainly focused quite a bit on the pains that are emerging in Trinidad as well as throughout the region more broadly. I'm wondering about some of the joys and dreams of the Caribbean. Where are you seeing gains being made? Where are you seeing emancipatory praxis? You're certainly engaged in it on a day-to-day basis, as well as into where are you finding hope amidst all of the frontline activism and political work that you're doing?
I see joys in young people, or younger than me people. I think my young people flag is a little bit tattered at this point. It's not fully gone. It has a few rips in it, I'm not gonna lie. But yeah, you see the different ways that younger people are interacting, the way how they speak, is different. And I think, justice on the whole, in terms of gender justice, economic, socioeconomic, their understanding of, capitalism is really kind of like more mainstream now. I mean, that has its pitfalls, but there are certain things that you kind of get out of the way. So it's almost like with every generation, it gets a little bit better, I hope. But that's what I'm seeing. So there are a lot more youth-led organizations that have emerged, I think, especially during the COVID period, because people, kind of were limited in terms of what they could have done in terms of going outside. So a lot of people in their free time would have established pages like on social media where folks can go to learn more about particular topics in terms of the climate change, gender, sex, etc. That's great. I think that's really good. And it's interesting to see, when you look back, like 10 years ago, what the landscape was like, and then, look at how it is now with so many youth-led organizations. So that's something that's positive for me. Dreams, I think working a little bit more on how we navigate the power relations between, the citizenship, civil society, and the state a little bit better, often it's kind of presented as you have to be strategic. You need to know the right people to talk to get what you need done, kind of way. And I mean, yes, and that's the fact of how how it is, but I'd like to see democracy in action a little bit more, where if I write a letter to, a minister, or, well, not a letter, an email, because who writes letters? But if I send an email to a government ministry saying something, then I get a response back. And it's not that the email bounced because the email inbox is full. Or if I call, and I want to have a meeting with somebody, I can. You want a more democratic space where everybody who lives in the space can, take up their civil duty and engage, with the state, in a way that is meaningful for both individuals. I mean, it sounds so simple, and it sounds like kind of like, well, this is what we were promised when we said we would have a government, but that has been the furthest thing from what we've gotten. And it affects everything. It affects every single thing. We're not going to get a closed loop landfill for the Beetham because landfills do not win elections. Landfills are not sexy enough. They don't attract funders, like you can't get nothing done with that. So then therefore, workers will continue to be put at risk at the landfills. Gender justice. That's like a whole other thing because if you side with the women, side with the queers, then you're going to lose the religious majority of people who purport to be religious. Like we can't keep doing maths like that with human rights. Like that can't be how we continue working. So I mean, something has to give, and I don't know what the it is.
Perfect way to sum up. I think a lot of the status quo, not only in the Caribbean, but throughout the rest of the world, something's got to give. And it's just basically, when will that give? And then, two, what can we do maybe to put ourselves in the service of that status quo collapsing or that center never holding? I'm wondering, Johanna, I wanted to touch upon some of the environmental politics of the Caribbean. You had mentioned workers as well as the landfill. What is that issue that you were talking about? I know that you've been engaged to some degree, solidarity actions with workers in Trinidad and Tobago, broadly related to some sort of aspect of environmental pollution or contamination. Could you maybe, in a couple of minutes, give us an overview of that, which I think will also signal to the listeners the degree to which you're also engaging in struggles for environmental justice?
You take two steps, you're confronted with a cause. Do you engage? Do you pass go collect 200? That's really the question on a regular basis. But essentially, the Industrial and General Workers Union have been advocating for the construction of a closed loop landfill at the Beetham landfill for been organized in terms of their advocacy for, I think, about 5 to 7 years now. This advocacy has come out of the work that landfill workers have been doing, working with the union, trying to get the construction of this landfill to be a priority by the government in terms of, taxpayers' investments, etc. And there have been a number of reasons, but I think the major reason has been because of the geography of the space. The landfill is located a few kilometers away from the capital, Port of Spain. It is also located across the highway from Beetham community, and it is lined by the Carony River, so which is one of our natural wetlands. So it's in this very sensitive area, and it's right now it's an open, landfill where, a lot of our countries rubbish is disposed. And there has been, research that has been done where the leachate is seeping into, seeping deeper into the soil, causing damage, but also seeping into the swamp, maybe causing health problems within the communities that, are around. So the landfill workers, they essentially have been doing advocacy for the construction of a closed loop landfill where these pollutants would not be able to cause harm to the humans as well as the environment in that area. It's been a struggle that is ongoing. There have been several protests. There have been letters written. There have been proposals written. It's an ongoing thing that has been happening.
Okay, I remember you had written a piece about this, I think, for Roar magazine at one point. So I think a variety of these different things that you're engaged in, we can also provide links to in the show notes so that people can become even more informed. We're coming up on time here. We've only scratched the surface with respect to what modernity has produced in the Caribbean, but also then to Johanna, with respect to all of the different aspects of movement building, of community engagement, as well as struggling for better worlds across the Caribbean that you're engaged in. We've only touched upon a few there. I'm wondering, as we wrap up, listeners will very much be able to hear more from you as both co-host and co-producer, along with Adeze Greenwich. Shout out to Adeze, who's also co-producer on the series. But I'm wondering, as we wrap up this episode, what are your thoughts about the crucible of modernity, focusing on the Caribbean, as well as the season to come?
In the podcast episodes to come, listeners have diverse perspectives from a diverse group of people based in the Caribbean, for the Caribbean, and we really hope that you all will join us along for the ride.
Okay. Thanks, Johanna. On that note, we hope that listeners will tune in the weeks to come as we start to survey the crucible of modernity that is the Caribbean.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe.
To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.